with Sarah Levine, who is most recently the author of, I'm not sure how we can say this while also respecting Stevenson. Should we say Treasure Island Chick Chick Chick? Should we say Treasure Island, maybe Island with the extra exuberance?
Yeah, I think it's the exuberance I want.
Treasure Island? Yeah, yeah. Something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Who's the author of Treasure Island? Sarah Levine, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
I'll try to do less of that as the conversation progresses. But anyway, I wanted to first of all ask you about just what it takes to create such a winsome, unlikable character and to perpetuate that for so long. How much do you feel is going over the line or is enough? What do you need to do to sort of invite the reader in to someone who is quite literally ineffable? There is no name for this character. So what of this? How does this start?
Well, it's how does it start, or how do I do it? I guess those are two
different. How do you do it?
Well, I've always been interested in unreliable narrators, and part of what interests me is that there's this gap between the narrator and the author, the implied author. And so I think what you have to do is vary that gap. Is if the character is completely unlikable, despicable all the way through, a reader will toss the book aside.
Yeah.
But I guess with this narrator, I thought, well, I'll let her have a few things. I'll take away compassion. I'll take away generosity.
Take away quite a bit.
Yeah, I took away a lot. But I will give her language.
Yeah.
I will give her verbal flair. And I think that maybe that's what keeps people interested.
Well, verbal flair as opposed to the flair in office space. I mean, what do you mean by this?
Well, I just think she has a, I would say, a syntactically ambitious voice.
Yeah.
It's a very written book.
Yeah. Taking qualities away. I mean, you know, how did so many qualities get taken away over the course of this? I mean, is this just the inevitable, your inevitable reaction to generating conflict to create someone who might even be described as sociopathic on some levels?
Mm-hmm. And has been, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Stevenson himself had this idea about character formation.
Yeah.
He said that it's a kind of psychic surgery.
Yeah.
And he described how he did Long John Silver, in fact. And he said, you know, knife in hand, he thought about a friend of his, Henley, and then he cut away all his finer qualities and left him with courage, but not much else. And I think that's what I was interested in doing, was taking somebody that I knew, but taking away those qualities that would help her on her passage. And,
yeah,
you know, for comic purposes.
So the verbal flair, the syntactic language, this is something of a buffer. This invites the reader into broaching someone who is just really unlikable normally, do you think?
Or? I think there has to be verbal energy there.
Yeah.
I think, you know, she's funny. If she weren't funny, I don't think it would be so fun to be in the company of somebody like that.
So humor is the secret way with which to peer into these sordid human qualities.
Perhaps.
Oh. So really, much of this was just really a way of, I suppose, keeping yourself entertained. That was really the MO for this book, so to speak.
Well, yeah, and I'm always interested in perception.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility is this tiny little part where the sister-in-law is talking about the money that her husband was supposed to leave to the girls, and within the course of one paragraph, although it's third person, you watch her rationalize how they shouldn't give the money to the girls. Maybe they'll just give her some dishes. They'll give them even the second best dishes.
Yeah.
And so I think with this book I was interested in rationalization and ego and certain psychological patterns.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to let her be devious in ways that I think all people are devious, but for the purposes of the story, she's more devious than most.
I saw an interview that you did with the Chicago Sun-Times on a blog where you said that you don't really believe in this idea that an author has a real or a natural voice. So this leads me to ask you, well, how is it real? I mean, does language serve similarly as this buffer that we're talking about here? That really, if there is no inherently innate voice, then what is there that is real for the reader, do you feel?
I don't know about the word buffer,
yeah,
but I think when I was talking about voice, I've long worked in the classroom, because I'm a teacher also, against the idea that what a writer's purpose is to find a voice, like there's some natural voice under the crud of all the bad grammar or all the lazy habits of thought that's waiting to be excavated. Because I think what serves the writer more is thinking about rhetorical functions and how differently you might write for different occasions. So what is a voice? It's not that it's completely or that I'm completely cynical and think that there's, you know, nothing authentic or real, but that I think that model of writing has held too much sway in the academy, and that it's more useful to talk about things like rhythm, diction, trope, syntax,
yeah,
in order to talk about how a voice is constructed.
Why is rhythm and diction more important to you than, I suppose, this realism? Is it just this academy perspective that you're talking about here?
Well, no, because if you're a writer, language is your medium.
Yeah.
You know, if there are many ways to be a storyteller, and I would imagine that if you're a storyteller with moving images, you know, in film, that you learn all the, well, you can tell me, all the craft of film technique. But if you're a writer, you need to know how to get in and out of sentences.
Sure. You have surrounded the unnamed protagonist. I'm not sure if we should call her up for the sake of this conversation.
One of the reviewers called her Gym Girl, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, that's good. The girl or whatever. You surrounded her with a number of very nice people. Lars, her friend as well. I mean, people tolerate her rather remarkably. On the other hand, this is a first-person perspective. And I'm curious, did you have a lot of these amicable side characters that you introduced in an effort to sort of, I guess, take the acerbic harshness of her qualities off? Or how did these come about? I'm curious.
Well, I think that when you have an unlikable narrator or a narrator whose worldview doesn't embody your own,
yeah,
that you need to indicate that to the reader. And there are many different ways that you can do that. But if you can embed into the book different points of view than hers, even if she can't register as a narrative consciousness what they're saying, because
yeah,
she's so narcissistic that she misses it.
Sure.
There's a way to explain to the reader, to signal to the reader, almost over the narrator's head, that there's another way to view these events. There's another perspective, another moral viewpoint, really.
Well, on the other hand, Up, who I'll call Up just
okay,
for the time of you, I mean, there's this very interesting quality in the book where you constantly have tables, and...
Tables.
Like, you're referring to surfaces. And I was reading this saying to myself, you know, I'm wondering if this is the one solitary hope that we have in this book, because we have these tables, which connotes, in my mind, the idea of just laying your things out onto a table. And what does she do when she deals with friends and she deals with her family, but lay things out? And I'm curious. I'm curious why why there were so many tables often in the dialogue scenes. I mean, it could just be the notion of eating burritos and so forth. But tables seem to stick out in my mind. I'm wondering why they featured so prominently in this book.
I hadn't realized that they featured prominently.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, tables feature prominently in my life, I suppose.
Yeah, all of our lives.
Right, so I hadn't noticed them. I wasn't at all aware of them as a motif. Can you say more about them? Is there a particular table in a particular scene? Or it was just simply that...
largely when they're eating burritos and things like that. I don't know. I just... There was a concern for the precise description of the table at times, which struck me as bizarre. Not just the table, but, like, describing the formica and so forth.
Oh.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, right. And also in the pet library.
Yes, in the
there's a preoccupation. Yeah, maybe that's the narrator's preoccupation with interior design.
Yeah.
And she has sort of a downward slide. You know,
not some subconscious hope here that maybe she might be aware that she is sort of laying out her narcissism to these other people. There's no redemption here.
No, I hadn't thought about that. It's a valid reading, but to me it was more noticing what sort of places she hung out.
Yeah. What about the short length of this book? I mean, did you have a previous draft that was extremely long, or was there a maximum amount of attention that any reader could deal with, that you, in fact, could deal with this person?
It's always been a short novel.
And
it was always conceived to be a short novel, and everything I do is short.
Yeah.
I'm interested in short prose forms. There was one long version after the editor bought it.
Yeah.
Alice Siebold. She said, go ahead and do whatever you want to do, and then we'll talk about that draft. And then I, you know, went nuts and wrote a longer version. And when I gave it to her, she said, you know what? Let's just go back to the first.
Really?
Yeah. So I think that for her, she said it was the kinetic energy of it. And what I think in a way what I did was I sold her a miniskirt.
Yeah.
And then when she said, go ahead, do whatever you want to do, and I started amplifying things, it was like I gave her a ball gown.
Yes.
And it has to be short. I think it has to be short and energetic and have the velocity of boys' adventure fiction, even though it's not an adventure book in any traditional sense.
What was in this longer draft that was so problematic, out of curiosity?
Oh, there was a lot more with Richard.
Yeah.
I developed Richard's character, and also he was in heat.
Yeah? It was more parrots.
More parrot stuff.
Yeah, and it just didn't work. I mean, it was just an effort for Alice to basically tell you can go further? Was that the whole purpose of this? Or was it just to kind of like, go ahead and work on this manuscript while I'm working on these other books or something like that?
Oh, it might have been that she was finishing. No, but I think she said that in her experience, she knew what it felt like to have somebody accept your book, endorse your book, and that maybe there's like a little bit further that you would go.
Yeah.
So she just said, you know, do whatever you want to do. And so I did, but I did it very rapidly.
Yeah.
And I'm a slow writer, and
yeah,
I believe in putting work in the drawer.
Yeah.
So what I turned into her, I didn't have time to let sit, and I was very happy to go back to the original draft, which
yeah,
I had let sit for quite some time.
So how close is the final product to the original draft, out of curiosity?
It's very close.
Yeah.
It's very close. There were two concerns that Alice had. One was she thought I had too many fat jokes.
Really?
And the other was about the pet library owner. She wanted
Nancy,
to clarify that the narrator's views about Nancy's were not my views.
Yeah. I was going to actually ask you about that. I mean, it could very easily be troublingly stereotypical, that dialogue. So what did you do to get that balance right, to really put the blame, so to speak, on up?
Well, I think there's a conversation with her and Lars where
yeah,
she actually starts imitating Nancy's accent in a tasteless way, and it makes him uncomfortable. So I gave him a line, which I don't remember now, but
yeah,
you know, he says you shouldn't talk like that.
Do you think there's a crisis in American fiction right now over presenting scabrous and unlikable characters? I mean, I've been seeing a lot of fiction that plays it safe, but I guess an imprint like Tonga comes along and allows these perspectives. Do you feel, where do you feel contemporary fiction, especially American contemporary fiction, is at on this question?
I don't really feel qualified to answer the question about contemporary American fiction.
Well, why not?
Well, because I don't think I read all that much contemporary American fiction. I mean, I do think that both of those concerns editorially, too many fat jokes and
yeah,
be careful with that, come out of a, you could say, a political correctness.
Political correctness or market conditions, wanting to win the readers so that the reader will hand over her hard-earned shekels.
Well, yeah, I mean, they weren't hard things to adjust in the manuscript.
Yeah.
They were pretty minor. And then the other editorial work that Alice did was just helping me emphasize certain things in relationship to the daughter and the mother.
I wanted to ask you just about the unnamed quality of the protagonist. I mean, we're given all these interesting details about her family, you know, the endless chips and chickpeas that are in the family home, but you almost aren't aware of the fact that she doesn't have a name until you get to the end. You think, what? Wait a minute, I don't even know this person's name. To me, it's almost like, I suppose, the inverse of a Facebook profile, where you know someone's name, but you may not necessarily know the precise details of somebody's life. And maybe this might relate to my initial query. Instead of talking about contemporary American fiction, I was wondering if we might talk about this idea of where 21st century fiction goes in relation to what we spill about ourselves. Was this kind of your solution to this at all? Or,
you know, the decision not to have her speak her name or have another character speak her name came out of that desire to put the emphasis on ego and the nihilistic, self-insulating ego, and thinking of the book as a mind space. And this may be wishful thinking on my part, but I hope that by not giving her a name, I was not giving the reader a handle
mm-hmm.
by which they could pick her up and throw her out.
Uh-huh.
I was aware that if I said her name was, give me a proper name.
John Self.
Sure.
Is a perfectly applicable one.
Or, you know, Bethany Rivers.
Yeah.
That immediately there would be an association with that name. And she is embedded in a sociological matrix. It's not as if she is every woman. By no means is she every woman. But I wanted to delay that judgment on the reader's part so that they would have a chance to identify with her.
Yeah. So you feel that a name is the ultimate handle to the reader? I mean, did you do other things to prevent the reader from grabbing onto crags in the book?
No, I thought the name was the one that I focused on. I mean, maybe I was thinking a little bit about Lydia Davis's work. Often she doesn't name characters, and it feels like she's concerned with the mindscape, and that was my concern also.
The Cymbeline-like ending of the book. I don't want to give it away, but...
Please don't.
It does involve a number of characters meeting up at the end. I'm wondering why you used this form of resolution, as opposed to tying up things gradually. And I know it's difficult to talk about this without spoiling the book, but it was very odd how it was like, all the characters come together at the end, and I immediately thought Cymbeline. So how did this come about? Was this just a...
Actually, that came about from talking to a friend of mine who's a Victorianist.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And we were talking about novel ends, and she said, oh, in Victorian novels, you always have everybody show up. Everybody shows up in the ending.
Yeah.
So, she just threw that out in a casual conversation, but it got me thinking, how would you get all these characters together? How might that happen, in a contemporary scene?
And you naturally chose that option.
Yes. It seemed to fit.
Why did that Victorian plot element appeal to you more than, say, other ones? I'm curious.
Well, I guess the challenge of gathering up everybody, letting them have their say, mm-hmm. Letting them talk back to this woman who's been taking up so much oxygen in the room, it seemed fair to give other people a voice, even though it's always going to be filtered through her telling.
Sure. I wanted to actually ask about the four core values, boldness, resolution, independence, and horn-blowing. I'm curious how they became the ultimate... components for Up. I mean, there's certainly a lot of bold, there's a lot of resolve in the original Treasure Island. There isn't so much the word independent in there. I don't think it actually appears. How did you decide upon these? And at what point did you, I guess, you sort of throw the original Treasure Island away and just kind of veer off of that and do your own thing?
Yeah. It's hard to remember to reconstruct that process, but I think I was aware of feminist issues, issues around female agency and thinking about what a woman of this age would be preoccupied with. So although there's not a lot about independence per se in Stevenson's Treasure Island, there is this major plot point of him leaving the cove, leaving his mother, and his father has to die first, and then he leaves his mother and he goes off with these older gentlemen in order to have the adventure. And so that was part of what the narrator was preoccupied with, was how easily Jim was able to break from his mother, because that's a harder thing for her to do.
Yeah.
In terms of how I used Stevenson's Treasure Island, I read it repeatedly, but often once my story was in motion, I knew, because she was such a bad reader, that I had permission to ignore certain things.
Yeah.
And I tried to give a nod to all those things that I was ignoring. I think somebody says, you never talk about the pirates, or you never talk about Long John Silver.
Yeah.
But it was really a scaffolding to build my story. And then where I most closely studied it and studied Stevenson's work was in the realm of style.
Yeah.
Looking at turns of phrases and certain words.
But as someone who is a reader, I'm sure this must have driven you crazy. If she's not cleaving to the text, are you the author doing this? Or, was there any sort of competitive mode inside your head of like, hey, come on, you could read this and actually parse it, or anything along those lines? Or,
you mean she could read it? I could make her read it?
Or you bet you were perhaps talking to her or something along those lines, or perhaps I'm giving you too much credit.
No.
Or I'm implying too much bipolarity inside your brain.
Well, I didn't want her to be a good reader, and I wasn't interested in having her do essays on Stevenson.
Yeah.
Which I guess is more like Ellen de Botton and the Proust. It wasn't... From the very beginning, I knew that it wasn't going to be an accurate, fair reading of Stevenson.
Yeah.
Because it was a comic novel.
Sure.
It was just not in that spirit.
Sure. You also... I noted you wrote an essay called The Essayist is Sorry for Your Loss, where you pointed out that most people in the English department are suspicious of the essay form, that academics are suspicious of humanism. I'm wondering, do you feel that any of these suspicions have crossed over into fiction at all, or that this might also have affected your I suppose, libertine offerings on the page?
You know, when I wrote that essay, I was a graduate student when I wrote that essay, and I think things have changed. Now there are so many creative nonfiction writing programs, whereas at the time there were only a handful. So I'm not sure that the conditions are the same.
Yeah.
What was the question, though?
Well, it was sort of like, I guess, the crossover between, you know, views from academics upon essays and how those are transferable possibly in some sense to fiction.
Yeah, well, I think there's, from what I've observed, there's suspicion about creative writers within English departments, always.
Yeah.
A kind of uneasiness with the makers and maybe a rivalry, you know, between the people who are devoted to the word as interpreters of the word and those who make it and are not... They're not responsible in the same way to the same historical, cultural, theoretical frameworks.
So do you have any vocational experience working in a pet store or anything?
In where?
In a pet store.
Oh, no, yeah. I never have.
Not really?
No.
How much of Up's experience have you possibly lived? Anything comparable? Moving back in with your parents?
No.
Stealing a boyfriend's apartment?
No. No animals were harmed in the writing of this book. My 25 was really different than her 25. I was a professor at the University of Iowa in their nonfiction writing program.
Yeah.
At that age. It's none of it is autobiographical.
Yeah. Well, then how do you find out how to treat a parrot terribly? I mean, this is not exactly the kind of question you go ringing up pet stores for. I mean, did you Google this?
No, I read a lot of books about parrots,
okay,
which really... really impressed me. I increased my respect for birds. There are a number of parrot memoirs out there. People have written books about their relationship with their parrot.
Really? What's the best parrot memoir?
I could look up and tell you later.
Yeah.
I could send you an email, but I can't remember for your listeners.
Yeah.
There's also an ethologist who does research on birds, and she wrote a really good book about her relationship with this bird named Alex. I'm forgetting now the name of her book or even her name, but there's a lot of really interesting reading on parrots that I got sucked into. Yeah.
Did you stare at the Chabon cover for inspiration?
No, I did not.
No, okay. Oh, I wanted to actually ask about this interesting contrast between Up's mundane life and the fact that she doesn't actually seek out any adventure. I mean, you know, how did you, Did this kind of contrast come about because because of constant removal of qualities? Were you responding in any sense to, I suppose, the American condition at all, or was it just really one individual whose qualities you were just gradually subtracting and putting into this novel?
I think I wanted to think about gender, and so the boys' adventure book is typically about going off, unburdening yourself of consciousness and following your desires. And it's also, although you could argue, shaped by the presence of women in the way that the Iliad is, you know, the whole war is started by a woman. It's about leaving the feminine behind, or an attempt to flee the feminine. So here I have a female narrator who falls in love with adventure fiction. She can't go live like a guy. She can't do this. There are reasons of temperament, but also she can't do it because I, as the writer, am interested in thinking about gender and what it means to live a life a certain way. So once I got her moving, I realized she cannot go out into the world. I don't want her to be the kind of woman that you and I both know, who get on a backpack and go off and do wonderful things. What I wanted to do was propel her into the domestic sphere and make her find the adventures of the heart, you could say.
Yeah.
Or consciousness that she was so eager to avoid. So to me, it was a meditation on gender by having her end up not going further out into the world, but deeper into her family.
Aside from parrot memoirs, what other research did you do? I'm curious. I mean, I want to know if there are any other genres of books we should be checking out later.
What did I do? I read a lot about Stevenson, and Stevenson is a fascinating figure. I pretty soon realized that I didn't want to use him as a character in the book, and so had to put that research aside. But I read every biography there is of him. I read his letters, his essays, all his work. I read some criticism on adventure and 19th century adventure fiction and imperialism. And then that's probably it. That and the parrot stuff, to try to understand how parrots move, even.
Yeah. So you had Stevenson before you had Up, so to speak.
I did, yeah. The book was born out of my love of Stevenson as a writer.
So really, for you, you have to, I suppose, marinate your brain in just a shitload of reading. And then a character comes somehow out of that?
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it isn't useful, per se. Yeah. You know, you have to be aware of what would just clutter up the story.
Were there any characters before Up that came out that didn't false starts, anything along those lines?
No, the book took a long time to grow. Yeah. I sort of see it in a Petri dish, just taking a really long time to develop. But the voice was there from the beginning, and the relationship with the mother was there from the beginning.
Yeah.
The two of them were in the very first passage that I ever wrote. It was actually about the narrator having her mother read the book and them having an argument about interpretation.
You were saying that you are a slow writer. Why do you think that you're more of a deliberator rather than someone who gushes? I mean, there's a theory that goes around where you're either a gusher or an eker. And I'm wondering why, you know, each sentence comes so slow, like a bottle of ketchup for you.
It's temperament, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I'm of a cautious, introspective temperament, which is probably why I could get such a laugh out of doing a story about a woman who cannot get the adventure started.
What causes you to, I suppose, agonize over sentences or have them come out slow? I mean, you're just sitting often in front of a computer for an hour and you get one sentence. Are you one of those types?
Or? No. It may not be that it comes so slowly. It's just that I believe in revision.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm sensitive to form. I'm formally ambitious, and so I want to pay attention to all these little micro dynamics. And
such as?
The stuff I mentioned earlier, you know, syntax, trope, rhyme, rhythm.
Yeah.
I'm very, very interested in form, so I won't just dash something off without going over it, combing over it.
Okay. Well, that seems a good place to end. Thanks so much, Sarah. It was a pleasure to chat.
Yeah, thank you.
Great, thanks.